thing I, nope, I'm going to keep talking and we're going to see if it works. Hello. So the thing I like about that hymn, in particular paired with Frederick Douglass's words, is that it comes from the African-American spiritual tradition. And so when we sit with the discomfort and the charge that Frederick Douglass shared 13 years before the emancipation of slaves, depending on how you want to look at it, that within the African-American tradition there was still that yearning and that call for peace and love and hope and joy somewhere. A story. Who here has heard of the promise to protect? There's a couple hands, all right. So I'll share a little bit about it. The Promise to Protect is a campaign that was started in the spring of this year for folks who were willing to join in the struggle to stop the Dakota Access, the Keystone Pipeline in the Dakotas. And so there was a tour, the Promise to Protect tour, that went all around the country where individuals were asked to make a promise to protect. A promise to protect the earth, the indigenous peoples of this land, to protect our home from environmental degradation that oil drilling and that pipelines will cause. And so there was a training this past April in Oakland that I attended, and they had organizers there from the Dakota area, they had organizers from local indigenous communities, and they trained us on what it looked like to show up and be in right relationship with indigenous communities when we do this work. And as part of that training, they trained us on how to do nonviolent direct action. So there was one activity that they did about nonviolent direct action that has stuck with me. It was a soccer game. So they first had five people volunteer. And they told them to go to this side of the asphalt field we were playing on. And then they had 10 people raise their hands to volunteer. And they went to this side of the asphalt field we were playing on. And then when we were told it was a soccer game, immediately the folks on the team of five had some questions. They thought it was unfair. They were going to be outnumbered. Those of us on the team of 10, which was me, I was really excited. I thought, yes, I get to play an oppressor in this game. And then the rule keepers, the folks who had been organizing this training, were the rule keepers in this game. They told the folks playing on the team of five that they could come up with three rules that the team of 10 absolutely had to follow. Yeah. Immediately, those of us on the team of 10 started to feel uneasy. The three rules that they came up with: you must always have your arm linked up with another player. You can only touch the ball with your non-dominant foot. And if you are planning to try to score a goal, you have to kick backwards. Okay, so maybe I'm not the oppressor in this situation anymore. So those of us that were on the team of five, or the team of 10, we tried everything we could to undermine those rules. We started to believe that the team of five was the oppressors because they were setting the rules. They had control over the game. They could do things that put us at a disadvantage. They could tell the rule keepers, hey, this person isn't following the rules, kick them out of the game. Those of us on the team of 10, we tried different tactics. We tried sitting on the ball and saying, we're not gonna play this game. We decided, forget the rules and just played soccer. It turned into what basically can be described as chaos. So at the end of this game, those of us that played and the rest of the folks that were at this training gathered in a circle to share our observations.
I was very amped up on my competitive energy, and I said, I played like I was one of the oppressed organizers, and we were making sure we were organizing ourselves and inviting people on the sidelines to join our cause, and we were not following the rules that the institution played for us, and all of these things. I was gung-ho about being the oppressed. The team of five said, what do you mean you had more players? So we kept going back and forth about how each of us felt we were oppressed in these rules, how each of us felt that we were at a disadvantage. And then somebody who had been watching the game asked a question. Why did the teams follow the rules at all? Why didn't they just work together? I deflated in that moment. In all of my self-righteous enlightenment, I had not thought big enough about what we could have done in that game. I was so focused on what we were fighting against, these rules, that group of five people that were making more and more rules to try to control our team, that I was limiting my own imagination of our strategies, of what was possible, of who we could work with. I was so focused on what I was fighting against that I forgot what I was fighting for. I was so focused on not following those rules, on breaking those rules, on winning against my fellow players that I hadn't even considered the possibility that we could collectively be fighting to liberate all of us from a set of rules that had all of us at a disadvantage. Just in different ways. I like to call myself a universalist Unitarian because I feel our universalism has that collective liberation that is so at the core of my own justice ministry. And that universalism, I forgot it in that moment. That universalism would have had me thinking about how to combine our efforts and visions, thinking beyond just these rules in front of me, thinking beyond an either or, and more into a both and. What if I had been grounded in my values of hope and creativity, not simply in that fabricated reality of adversity, scarcity, control? I could have imagined something, we could have imagined something, and then created something where we just played 5-on-5 soccer. Where we said, forget it, let's play Foursquare. Why didn't the two teams work together? At the end of the activity, the organizers of the training shared the title of the activity. Soccer for Suckers. We are all familiar with this fighting against focus. It's one that we encounter and likely engage almost every day. That despair, that seeming scarcity, that futility that we feel fighting against a system or a game that feels just stacked against us, that is all too real to us today. Just to name a few that can go on that ever-growing laundry list, we've seen the abortion bans happening in recent months. We've seen the criminalization of pipeline protests. We continue to see homelessness on the rise and the housing crisis exploding in this state. We continue to see police violence against Black lives. Trans discrimination being allowed back into healthcare. And what's right in front of our eyes these days, the immigration policies that have children and family separated and in what can be called nothing less than concentration camps. There is plenty for us to fight against. There's so much that can cause us fear and anguish, grief, despair, and frankly, anger. And we know, we've seen it happen in history, that it can get worse. These feelings we have, they are very valid and very real, and sometimes can feel like the only thing we have. And I'll be honest, when I'm angry, it mobilizes me. It can get me moving. But it's not enough. We know what we're fighting against. But what are we fighting for? What is the world we want to create? I thought about this much more intentionally this past week in a very real situation where the stakes were much higher than a 5-on-10 soccer game. This past Monday, myself and several other interfaith leaders met with Pelosi's staff in San Francisco. We were there to respond to the recent emergency spending bill that had been passed in the House. We were there to express our disappointment. Our disappointment at how it continued to perpetuate the issues at hand when it came to immigration, continued to put money in the hands of folks causing harm to families, to children, to communities. Our group of about a dozen of us, we kind of danced around that issue at first. We danced around our disappointment. We shared gentler feedback. And the feedback we got was equally plain. The feedback we got was, well, there's future bills you can focus on. There's midterm elections. We're in a blue state, we need to talk to the people in the red states. We need to get them to understand. All of that is fine and good and real, and they are strategies that we do attempt, we do pursue. But we kept going in that circle of dancing around disappointment and talking about these long-term issues, long-term approaches. So finally, one of our colleagues in that dozen interfaith leaders from the Council on American and Islamic Relations, he spoke from his heart. He wasn't planning to speak at that meeting. His first words were, "I'm not feeling the urgency. Where's the deep love?" He went on to say that deep love looks like defunding these people who are manifesting harm and suffering, not giving them money. That deep love meant putting money back into communities, into supporting families who are supporting their migrant and refugee family members who are coming into the country. Where is the urgency, he asked, where people are literally dying, where there are horrific violations against humanity, and we are talking about language and midterm elections. I nearly broke out into applause when he said that, and I will tell you, Pelosi's staff was taking some furious notes when he said that. And the conversation shifted. In that moment, we were able to hold our leaders accountable to the people who they are telling to do more work. We told them we are doing it, but we need you to have our backs. We are holding the line, but we need to know you are right there behind us, beside us, holding it too. We told them we need you to join in that act of deep love that says no and risks acting that no out. See, part of knowing what we are fighting for, that necessary first step, is not only talking about what we are fighting against, but holding that line and actually saying no to oppression, being active in our resistance. Going to the mat, as Pelosi was charged several months ago. Feeling that deep urgency and acting on it. I read to you earlier Frederick Douglass's What to the Slave is the 4th of July. He speaks of that urgency, and every year I return to that reading on the 4th of July as a spiritual practice, and this year especially, it's felt really relevant. And one particular paragraph stood out to me. At a time like this, scorching irony, not convincing argument, is needed. Oh, had I the ability and could reach the nation's ear, I would today pour out a fiery stream of biting ridicule, blasting reproach, withering sarcasm, and stern rebuke. For it is not light that is needed, but fire. It is not the gentle shower, but thunder. We need the storm, the whirlwind, and the earthquake. The feeling of the nation must be quickened. The conscience of the nation must be roused. The propriety of the nation must be startled. The hypocrisy of the nation must be exposed, and its crimes against God and man must be proclaimed and denounced. Frederick Douglass spoke of that urgency, of that need to remember what is happening to people in this moment, and risking to challenge people who refuse to see it. I want to invite everyone to take a breath with me. I love music as a way to connect me to organizers and movements of today and the past and hopefully the future. Hopefully we won't need as many organizers in the future. But there's a song that comes out of today's movements that I'd like to invite you to sing with me. I will start it. It's pretty simple, the first part. And then if we feel like we've got it, I'll add a second part. And those of you who are more musically inclined, you can go ahead and join me. It's not in your hymnal. We're gonna sing this from the heart, y'all. We're gonna do it this way. The words are, we're gonna rise up till it's one. We're gonna rise up till it's one. We're gonna rise up. Keep singing that. Choice to rise up, whether in this moment or tomorrow. When we're at a water cooler, I think that's the image we use now with offices, the coffee shop, and somebody says something. And we don't know whether we feel we can challenge them on it. Somebody says something that we know is a reflection of the harms in our world. It takes a lot to risk in those moments. So what helps us take those risks? What helps us rise up? What helps us keep coming back? One of my colleagues in ministry shared this several months ago, and it continues to resonate with me. We have to be more than the war loves. Somewhere in all of this, we've got to be the world that's worth fighting for. I come back to that quote every so often, and especially when I think about what deep love means to me. Answering evil, countering oppression, it's not the end goal of our faith. So what is? What is at the core of who we are and the world that we want to see? The world that our Unitarian Universalism tells us is possible. Some of you know that I'm a UU Muslim, and one of the pieces of that identity is this theology of remembrance, of reminder, of returning. This idea that there are ways in which we can intentionally turn back to the good, turn back to love, turn back to compassion, turn back to that house where we are safe, where there is mercy. Thank you for that song. Prayer 5 times a day, fasting, zakat, the charity, going on hajj, just being in community. Those are all practices. Singing is a big one of mine. So what are they? What are your practices? What are your community, your communities, your intentions? What are the things that you turn back to? The values, the practices and activities, the breaths that remind you of what is at the core of your Unitarian Universalism. Some of you may have some. Some of you may in this moment be realizing, oh snap, I don't have any. And that's okay. There's still time to come up with some. This morning I was looking at this quilt and was in awe of the values it centers. And I invite you at some point today to take a look at it. It comes from your community. And it really centers the world you want to create. And those pieces of the world we want to create already exist. There are those glimmers, those glimpses of deep love that already exist in our world. In the Quran, there are numerous verses that say there are signs all around you. There are glimpses and glimmers of deep love all around you. Here, even in this room, I'm sure there is a person you can turn to and realize that they have been there for you and shown you deep love. So when we're in this moment where we are being asked to rise up and rise up and rise up again and again and again, what do we return to? to fill that well? I can't answer that question for you. That's the beauty of our Unitarian Universalism. But I invite you to think about that. What do you return to and how? There's one more song that we'll sing that comes from the movements. This one some of you may know, Olam Chesed Yibane. I don't know if there's anybody that knows it. We'll sing a simplified version. But Olam Chesed Yibane, which is Hebrew, and the English is, we will build this world with love.
Olam Chesed Yibane.
Deep love is something we manifest together. Deep love is something that is always there for us, with us. And deep love is something that calls us to act, to rise up, and to return again. Because we know another world is possible. See you there.